This program is brought to you from the Margaret Faro Studio.
Hi, and welcome to this edition of Newsmakers. I'm your host, Emily Fannin. Today, we're talking about closing the gap in affordable housing. And with me right now, joining me is Representative Romaine Quinn, a Republican from Cameron, and Dr. Kurt Paulson from the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, who is a professor in urban and regional planning. Both of you, thank you so much for joining me on the program today. So talking about this, we're going to highlight a group or a package of bills that is aimed at tackling Wisconsin's affordable housing crisis. And right now, you know, the economics are just not in favor of building those starter homes. So right here, you see a list of bills that are making their way through the legislative process. And we're going to highlight each one of them that you see here on your screen. So Republicans and the state building and real estate industries have really been touting these bills of creating more affordable housing for workers, to reduce regulations, and to reform outdated practices. Some of these bills provide low to zero interest loans for a variety of housing projects and take steps to make it easier for developers to approve projects at the local level. Before we dive into these bills, I first just want to talk about what is causing such a shortage of housing. So with that, I'm going to first start with you, Kurt, on this issue, because you authored a report from 2019 called Falling Behind, and kind of lists several factors of what's causing these. So I'm going to highlight some of those right now. You know, we're hearing often about that they're not building enough homes to keep up with the pace of, you know, rising populations. Construction costs are also outpacing inflation and income. There's outdated use land regulations, et cetera, et cetera. So, Kurt, from this report, I guess, what else can you highlight of what's really causing all of this to make this housing crisis here in Wisconsin and across the nation?
Well, thanks for having me. And I wrote that report pre-COVID, and largely in the last couple of years, things have gotten worse. So construction costs are up 35%. So when people look at existing housing and they wonder why existing housing is going up in value and price, it's if the cost to build something new goes up, then the cost of existing housing also goes up. Interest rates have really skyrocketed in the last year, and that's really impacted on housing affordability. And then what we've also seen in the last 2 years is that housing vacancies have declined to record low levels. So the way to think about it is if you're going to move to an area for a job or a job change, or you want to move up, find more space for your kids, or move down when your kids move out of the house, you're looking at what's available in the market. And normally in our housing market, 1 or 2% vacancy means that there's a balance between supply and demand. For homeownership, we're less than 0.5% vacancy in the last 2 years. So you just have more people chasing fewer units. The other issue is that with interest rates, when they were really low during the pandemic, people like me, we refinanced our house. So I can't afford to move. So even as baby boomers age and might want to move down and open up that housing for a family, they really can't afford to move. So it's the same trends. It's taken a decade to get us into this hole, but it's just accelerated in the last couple of years.
Now, Representative, what are you specifically hearing from constituents? Because, you know, I also just recently, and I would say finally, was able to find a house and got an offer accepted. It was a lengthy process, looked for several months. Inventory is low. I mean, what are you hearing specifically on the grounds from constituents and why you wanted to be a part of this package of bills as well?
Well, I think I'm in a unique position because I am a realtor when I wear my other hat outside of the state capitol, and I see it firsthand on those that I've been trying to help find a home, like you in your situation, where they're just not out there. We're looking for months. We're writing offers that are $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 over asking price with no contingencies, and we're getting beat out. Or on the flip side, where I have a seller and I'm selling a home, and I have 10 offers in a weekend, and I've sold it for over asking price with no contingencies very quickly, and I could have sold 10 of those homes. So it's hard because you're excited for your client, but you know there's now 9 other people that didn't get the home that need a home that are in a situation where They're looking to upgrade or move or something. And I hear it everywhere for every reason. It affects economic development, the growth of our communities, our school systems. You know, families can't move here. They don't bring their kids with them into our schools, which is how we fund them per pupil. We have employers that people love to come to the community and they can't find a place to live. I have a school superintendent that's driving an hour just to get to his school where he took a new job. I have a police chief driving 45 minutes from one community to the next because he can't buy a home in the community he serves. So it literally affects everyone of almost every income range right now, to the point where it really is a crisis.
So let's talk about some of the solutions that you have brought forth along with Representative Brooks in the assembly. Let's first start with what is called anti-not in my backyard. So this proposal, in a sense, would increase certainty and predictability in the development approval process by giving local governments more power to resist neighbors who challenge new housing developments. Now, there could be a whole host of reasons why there is this opposition, but it typically includes a few reasons. One, I would say, quality of life. People don't want changes. Also, maybe they fear that it could be an increase of crime with new houses, traffic congestion, lower property values, etc. The bill would also give developers more tools to challenge the review process. And another bill would make it harder for residents to sue after a project was approved. So kind of setting up the situation right now, builders need approval from local officials because they control this entire process where new homes can be built. And sometimes residents interfere with this process by putting pressure on local authorities to try and persuade them to turn down projects. So, Representative, I'll start with you on this topic. I mean, where did this idea come from? Is it mainly people on the grounds that are telling you this is what's happening and this can really, getting rid of some of these regulations could help?
Well, builders need certainty, right? We're in northern Wisconsin, even in southern Wisconsin, we have this much of a window in our weather system that allows us to even build. And so we need the certainty to say, hey, when we, what is the timeline for approval when I apply for that permit or conditional use permit? And then I need to know I can go ahead because time is money. And lining up the lumber, the materials, the labor, we have to have that certainty. And unfortunately, some of the processes we have in place where if you get a big enough group of neighbors to go in and complain at that last zoning meeting or that last planning commission meeting, they could put things on hold. They could move the goalposts for developers and inadvertently drive up the cost of construction. So let's say they don't want as high of a density. So we don't want those small of lots. Well, you're going to increase the price of the home for everyone that's left. So now your home that went for $250,000 is now going to be $280,000, $290,000, $300,000 because heaven forbid you live nearby and are telling your neighbor what size lot he or she should be able to build their house on. So it is very much a kind of a NIMBY argument, not my backyard. And I've heard some of this. I don't want those people near me. I don't want those kind of people, that might quote unquote live in an apartment building or live in a smaller home than me. So I don't buy some of it. Locals have a right to input on what their community should look like. I get that. But we are at such a point in our housing crisis that some of it needs to be reasonable or not at all. Because we have to get these projects moving along. Perfect example, I think there was an apartment complex in Wauwatosa, and the community kept moving the ball on the project to the point where it went from, a couple hundred apartments now to the developer just said, forget it. And he built a car wash, I think, and no units went in. And so those are the kinds of situations we're really trying to hone in on and for that legislation. I'm a former mayor myself. I appreciate public input. I get the process. But there are times, and I've seen it, where four people show up at a meeting that no one else is at and complain, and it throws a project off. Well, what about the 100 people that would have found a home? Like, don't they matter too? So I think it's just trying to give certainty to developers and saying, communities, you set your rules. But once you set the rules, you have to actually follow them. And so I wouldn't say it's telling communities what they have to do. We're saying set your code, set your zoning, set your plans. But when those plans are set, you can't deny a developer the ability to build a project that fit your standards today.
And Senator, you brought up a good point. You come from a local government background, but we often hear from Republicans that they don't want to interfere with local control. So how would you respond to critics that say this is somewhat restricting local control?
Well, it's not. Like I said, we're telling them to now what communities will have to do And this is why the League of Municipalities was neutral. If it was really taking away local control, the league would not have been for this. They're neutral. And so all it says is gives them a window of period to say, let's do a deep dive into our zoning and or into our planning commission, into our codes that define how we want our neighborhoods. And once we do that and set that, you just have to follow your own rules. And so it's not taking away their ability to set what they want their communities to look like, but it's saying you have to follow your own rules. And then some of the other bills that we'll talk about incentivizes communities to make those changes. We'll help you with these revolving loan funds if we show you've made progress on rethinking the way you think your neighborhoods need to be.
Now, you did mention that the League of Municipality is in support of a lot of these other bills, but they are neutral on this. I guess, how are you trying to persuade them to give them, you know, to them to support this measure?
Well, they won't be. They're not opposed to the bill either. They speak highly of it in committee. They just know there's going to be a lot of education to do for their own members. And if they have a handful of members that just don't want it, we heard some of their own members, municipal leaders, come to the committee and testify for the bill, especially people that do the planning commission work. And so I think their members are a little mixed on it. No one's necessarily opposed to it. But it just requires them to do a little more upfront work to say, hey, you know, what are the rules in place? Because we have to actually follow them now once this bill passes.
Kurt, how would some of these changes ease roadblocks that drive up prices?
Right. And I think it's important to say that bill does not take away local control or stifle public input, right? I think it actually brings about good planning, because the whole point of the comprehensive plan is to say what you want, where you want it, and then make it easy for developers to build. It also means what you don't want, where you don't want it. But as Senator Quinn pointed out, and we hear these stories all the time, if a developer looks at the zoning and does an analysis, hires an architect, an engineer, puts a lot of money in to buy the property and expects to build 100 units because that's what the zoning says you should be able to get, and then the process is delayed and denied and whittled down to 85 units, right? A four-story building becomes a three-story building, or expanded stormwater. The cumulative effect is to drive up the cost of housing, because if you deny units, the demand doesn't go away. Those households just move somewhere else and put pressure on the housing market. Yep. So we like to say housing dies a death of 1,000 cuts. Every delay in the process, every regulation adds to the costs. Some regulations are obviously important. You need sidewalks, you need stormwater. But as the senator pointed out, a developer needs certainty, right? Time is money. And if you can't build what you think the market wants in a certain area, you're going to go somewhere else. But that market demand doesn't go away. So reducing the regulations, increasing the certainty of the process will help lower the cost of housing. But obviously there's other barriers in terms of interest rates, construction costs, that we can't adjust at a state level right now.
Yeah, I guess, is that also a challenge too? You know, you're battling with not only a Wisconsin problem, but a national problem because of how expensive it is of those who have dreams of building their dream home right now. Construction costs are just insane. And that a lot of that has to do with, you know, the pandemic and a lot of supply chain issues. But, you know, it doesn't appear like those, you know, that's easing anytime soon. So I guess, can you speak to that a little bit, Kurt, about how
Sure.
this, you know, we might not see a drop in prices anytime soon?
Well, there's multiple components that go into building a home or building an apartment. So the infrastructure costs, which I know we'll get to, that can be 15 to 25% of the costs. That's also affected by the supply chain. Price of fuel, right? Lumber itself is only 20 to 25% of the cost. We also have a labor shortage, which I know that there's been some interest in and some investments in terms of creating partnerships with community colleges, local building trades to develop the next workforce. But yeah, I mean, the construction costs have driven up the cost of housing 20 to 25%. So some of the bills that are being considered would help to lower those costs back down to something closer to a normal market.
All right, now let's move on to kind of the gap of what it costs to build a home and what working class Wisconsinites can actually afford. And, you know, these bills are being proposed in hopes to fill that gap a little bit by offering zero interest loans on workforce housing. I do also want to bring up, before we get into a lot of what these loans would do, who would qualify for them, we often hear this phrase of workforce housing. Let's first just describe to our viewers of what is workforce housing. So, Kurt, I'll start with you. Can you describe to our audience what that means?
Sure. There's two ways to think about it. So one is just the idea that if you work in a community, you should be able to afford to live in that community. And as Senator Quinn pointed out, a school principal, a police officer, a fire chief, right? But it's also people who cut your hair and clean office buildings. We need a range of housing at different prices for every city, because that's what your workforce is earning. So, but the more narrow definition of workforce housing is people who make a little too much to qualify for the federal subsidies, which really is targeting the lower income bands, but not enough to afford a decent quality place to live within the market. So within the bills, we use this concept in housing called the area median income. So what the average family would earn. And it's really that middle income band that is being squeezed in the housing market right now that a lot of these bills would help. So this would help someone who's a production worker in a factory, a starting teacher, a nurse, that kind of income band is really the workforce housing that is in short supply.
So let's now dive into these loan programs and what some of these other bills would do. In a sense, basically says, you know, if builders want to fix up older homes or construct new ones, they could apply for zero interest loans under this proposal. There's also what's being coined as the Main Street Rehabilitation Bill. So in order to qualify for something like that, there's a lot of qualifications. It must be located on the second or third floor of an existing two or three story building with commercial use on the main floor, constructed at least 40 years prior to the loan application, and has not had any significant improvements over the last 30 years, and that the building is vacant or underutilized. You know, Senator, looking at this, how do you see this bill specifically really appeasing to people to apply for these loans and, you know, be fixer-uppers in the community?
Yeah, it's huge. I think almost every single community that I represent in the 25th Senate seat has the potential to create more livable units, apartments, above their old downtowns. I mean, we are constantly talking about how do we revitalize our downtowns instead of just watching our communities sprawl out to the interchanges and to the freeways. Well, here's a perfect example. Get more bodies downtown. And part of that is let them live there. And so if you walk down almost any main street in small town Wisconsin, there are going to be opportunities where there are open spaces above bars, restaurants, storefronts that just need a little shot in the arm. And some, a developer might find it attractive. So a lot of these may not be multi-units. It may be one unit. And so you're not getting the economies of scale. And so if I can get you a zero interest loan to kick off your project, it might be more enticing for a developer that otherwise might walk away and want to go build something with more units. And so we've got, it's actually an opportunity for some of the smaller guys too. We talk about developments of people bringing in 40 unit apartments or 100 single family homes. There's a lot of guys that and gals that work and they restore a few homes a year, or they flip a few places a year. This would really give them the opportunity to dive into some of those Main Street buildings and open these units back up at a rate that people can afford to rent, because they're probably historically not the most ideal place to live. And so it really is aimed at a market of people that they can afford something.
Right. And there's also another proposal that specifically targets homeowners, that they could receive up to $50,000 in a low to zero interest loan if they make necessary repairs to a home. I know, you know, if you buy an older home, there's going to be some touch-ups that you would have to do, but those by no means are affordable. So, you know, Kurt, this goes back to just the cost and rising costs of everything. Of course, this would be beneficial to anyone, but can you kind of just speak to the volumes of, you know, these rising costs and these loans and how they compare together to, you know, help new homeowners just, I guess, ease some of the financial challenges that they'll face. While it's exciting to get into a home, these are the other things that they're going to have to deal with.
So there's two issues there. For the smaller units above the Main Street businesses, a lot of developers, builders, small builders won't touch those because the economics doesn't work. And people have to understand that someone who builds homes or develops property, that is a business, and you got to make the math work. Otherwise, you can't get a loan from the bank. And so, as part of that capital stack, you're paying 7, 10, 12% interest rate on a loan from a bank. That really makes a project unaffordable or just something that doesn't pencil out. So a zero interest loan to rehab existing buildings really makes that economics work for a small builder. And for the homeowners, we know that when young people want to move into an area, they're looking for something that's move-in ready. And if it's an older home, because we haven't built as much in the last 50 years, most of our housing is older than our neighboring states. The economics, again, just are very hard for someone to buy a home, fix it up, and roll that that fixing up cost into the mortgage. So if the previous homeowner can get a low interest loan, pay it off over time, you can really make the economics work. During the pandemic, we had a statewide homeowner assistance funds, people applying for assistance to fix up older homes. And the volume of requests just demonstrated how much need there is for older homes, whether it's the roof or the furnace. We need to build a lot of new housing, but we have to protect and preserve the housing we have, because that's going to be the affordable stock for families and for workers.
Yeah, and Senator, these package of bills also deal with zoning ordinances, which we kind of talked about a little bit in the beginning of this show, but they don't require municipalities to change their zoning standards, which is a little bit different from a package of bills, kind of similar to these that we saw introduced in the previous session, because there was a little bit of slight opposition. I guess, how do you feel this time around that there's been some tweaks added, and are you a little bit more hopeful that these could get through the legislative process this time around?
Yeah, so far I don't envision any road bumps. I think it's well recognized by the governor in his administration, by the leadership in both of our houses, that there's a need. I mean, the fortunate part of it being a statewide crisis now is that it's not a regional issue. So it's not a handful of us screaming from the top of the roofs, or lack of roofs, that we don't have enough housing. It's in every community. It doesn't matter if you're in Brookfield or if you're in Superior. There's not enough housing. Workforce housing in Brookfield might be $350,000. Workforce housing in Superior might be $185,000. And our bills are drafted in a way to recognize the differences. So that's why I think there's going to be a broad bipartisan appeal to every one of these pieces of legislation, because as you mentioned, it's the carrot. It's not the stick approach. We're not making communities do anything, but for those that want to be proactive, you're going to be rewarded. And we're going to incentivize developers to come to your town to deliver the type of housing that your constituents need.
What type of feedback have you heard from Democrats on these?
Well, we just had I'm chair of the Senate Committee on Housing, Rural Issues, and Forestry. And through the hearing, it was probably 4 or 5 hours. I was constantly talking to my counterpart, Senator Spreitzer from Beloit. And, he has, besides a few tweaks, technical fixes we've talked about, he's right on board. So I don't see any issue of these not being bipartisan.
And we know they always have to reach the final hurdle with Governor Tony Evers. Any discussions there that you've had with him or his staff about the likelihood of whether he would support or oppose these?
Not yet. I mean, I would be pretty bewildered if he opposed them. I think he had some housing initiatives in his own budget. So there may be some differences in how we approach it, but I don't see any of these bills having any kind of concept in there, considering there's no registered opposition, why he would not sign them.
And of course, there's a funding component to this. Have you had discussions with joint finance, or is this going to be separate from the budget? Obviously, they are bills, but they're always the ones that are making decisions as this process goes on, as we're also seeing you guys pass bills, but also the budget committee doing their work as well. Has there been any discussion specifically on whether the funding is there?
Yeah, I mean, we don't operate in a vacuum. Everything we do is tied to something else, because all the funding's coming from a similar pot. So I've been keeping our caucus up to date. Representative Brooks has been keeping his caucus up to date. I know the speaker on numerous occasions has been talking about investing $1 billion into these bills. Representative Brooks in committee mentioned, you know, he'd love $500 million for the infrastructure specific bill. That's the one I led on. And then like $50 million for some of the others, whether you're talking about Main Street rehab or rehabilitating older homes. And so those are going to be massaged and worked out yet. The nice thing is we're at a unique time where we have a lot of one-time money, maybe not as much ongoing, but one-time money. And these are all structured in a way to continue to develop affordable workforce housing in perpetuity. So if there is ever an opportunity where we can't figure out or want to invest one-time money that will pay dividends, it really is these bills. Because when we're all gone someday, these bills will continue to function and recirculate dollars into our communities to build homes for the average worker. And so that's what's pretty exciting about how these are drafted.
Now, there's no one all solution to fix this housing crisis. So, Kurt, I want to go back to you. What are you maybe seeing on the national level, or are these similar bills that you're seeing in other states that we've been talking about that could be solutions, or what else maybe is out there that others are doing?
Right. So a number of states have passed or tried to pass various what I call substantive zoning reform laws. California, Wyoming, or Montana, I'm sorry, New York, that one failed. But that's not what any of these bills do. But those substantive bills would say cities of a certain size have to approve accessory dwelling units, or they have to allow up to 3 units on a parcel, or reduced parking requirements either everywhere or near transit. So there's a lot of those kind of substantive bills that other states are doing, again, to try to not just improve the process, but improve the substantive outcome of how much you can build. Other states are expanding their state housing tax credit, and there's a bill, AB 39, that does that here in Wisconsin. And then on the funding source, you see states like our neighbor state, Minnesota, that has a rural workforce housing tax credit. So various sorts of either low interest loans or tax credits to encourage more housing to being built. And of course, what we all need is for the federal government to provide both resources and some incentives for either zoning reform or change some of the federal rules about tax treatment of single family homes or the condo finance rules. So that's getting into the weeds, but I think you're seeing every state recognizes we have a shortage of housing, and that really puts the pressure on everybody. It's all hands on deck. It's zoning reform, it's financing, it's tax credits. But we won't solve the issue next year because it's taken us a decade or two to build it, to kind of unbuild ourselves into this situation.
I guess, you know, no one wants to picture this, but there's always the discussion of us hitting a recession again. You know, what happens if we see another housing market crash? I mean, what do you see in your view of what could happen and how worse the situation get if we get to that point?
Well, I don't think we're going to see a housing recession and significant decline in housing prices, because in the last year, interest rates have gone up and house prices did not fall, right? And that's because the price was not sensitive to the financing, the interest rate. Prices are going up because there's a shortage of housing and construction costs are going up. So there's a couple scenarios. If construction costs always stay high, then housing's always going to be expensive. So that's kind of almost a worst case scenario. But I don't know what we're going to be able to do to bring down the cost of construction back to something normal. But, you know, if there's a recession, housing demand will decline. And that will put a real squeeze on people who are looking for housing. If we have a significant recession, you'll see people start doubling up. People start moving back in with their parents. And so that will reduce some of housing demand and housing prices will fall a little bit. On the other hand, you know, we need the Federal Reserve to loosen up on those interest rates. But it's understandable that they're trying to fight inflation. So there's, you know, I don't think on a national level things are going to get necessarily better or worse in the next couple of years.
All right, I'm going to hold you to that.
Well, we're stuck, right? The housing market's stuck. Right. Baby boomers are staying in their homes. People who currently own a home can't afford to move. At the same time, millions of millennials are looking to find a place to own and put down roots. And so as a state, you know, if we don't retain and recruit our workforce, then that is a worst case scenario because jobs and people will start fleeing to other states.
Exactly.
And Senator, we just have a few minutes left. So, you know, what is your final, you know, push? What is your final message here of why we need to do this now instead of delaying it for a few more years?
Yeah, we can't wait. We should have been doing this for quite some time ago. And we're going to look back at this time. And if we do nothing, it's going to be a big problem because like Kurt just mentioned, we are pricing out an entire generation from home ownership. And so we're going to look back at this time and the sociologists are going to study it. And long time from now, we're going to see what the consequences are of that. The days of you being able to buy a nice ranch home in a small community in Wisconsin near the school and raise your family and build equity. And then someday it's updated and you sell it and make a few bucks. That's how you build wealth, generational wealth. And right now, if we do nothing, we are locking an entire generation out of the ability to be able to build wealth. And so all of these bills, they're not silver bullets, but they're working in connection with one another to address the root causes of this. And I think doing nothing is not an option. And even for those that have a home or you know, people just need to, you know, go to a different community or make more money and purchase a bigger home. The problem is those that own businesses and such, they need workers. And you can't attract workers if they have no place to live. And so we really are in a race with other states. We have a unique opportunity to if we do this now and we become the attractive place to live because we have options, which many places in the country don't, we could actually grow our state. And that's something that we have to do universally, liberal, conservative, no matter what, where you fall on the spectrum. We need growth. We need bodies to fill the jobs we have today. And housing is a key component of that.
It definitely goes hand in hand, addressing the worker shortage with also the shortage of housing. All right. Well, I appreciate you both coming on the program to talk about this issue. Thank you again. And that's it for this edition of Newsmakers, focusing on the shortage of workforce housing. Thanks for joining us.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civic broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.